Friday.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today's conversation may rock your world. For years, the conventional wisdom about charities and giving to charities has been to examine how much of the money donated to a charity actually goes to the cause the giver is supporting. We were told that 15% overhead was a legitimate expectation, with 85% of the money being donated going directly to the cause. We were also told to take a close look at how much a charity was paying its chief executive, a salary mirroring what a CEO of a private company might receive was probably too large. Well, along comes our guest today, who is ready to explode all of that. He says charities would be more effective if they were run like a business, and that those of us who donate should be looking at outcomes, on what charities accomplish and not on how much they spend. Further, he says that conventional wisdom actually limits the effectiveness of the charities we support. That guest is Dan Pallotta, activist, fundraiser, social entrepreneur, and founder and president of the Charity Defense Council. He is also the author of several books, including Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential, and Charity Case, How the Nonprofit Community Can Stand Up for Itself and Really Change the World. And we're giving Dan Pallotta a whole hour to explain himself this morning, because this may be something that's difficult for our listeners to wrap their head around. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Although it occurs to me that as a nonprofit, we could profit from this conversation here at WFAE.
Absolutely. I've spoken to various NPR chapters, actually, about that.
On the Charity Defense Council's website, your organization's website, is this fact. 70% of Americans believe that charities waste money. That's according to an NYU study. Why do you think that we believe that?
I think because the focus is always on expenses. When we talk about charity, all we talk about is how much are they spending. How much are they spending on overhead? And when you hear the word overhead, you equate that with waste. It's like saying, you know, don't think of an elephant in a pink cocktail dress, right? When you talk about overhead, that's all people associate with charity. So I think that's why a lot of people think charities waste a great deal of money. Interestingly, there is no study out there that shows that charities actually do waste money.
Where did the idea come from then?
Well, I think it comes from these sensational stories where a reporter may pick some particular charity that has 70% overhead or 60% overhead. The nonprofit sector has no articulate, powerful national voice to be there on the radio or on television to offer an alternative point of view. So that point of view sticks, that charities spend too much money and they waste a lot of money on overhead.
One of your missions is to change the way we think about charities and executive compensation and overhead. And you characterize the way we think today as hallucination. That's a pretty strong word. Do you really think that's a fair word to use?
I think it's probably not strong enough. you know, people give their hard-earned money to charity because they care about others. They care about people who are suffering. They care about people who are sick and who are poor. And what they really want is for poverty to end, and they want for breast cancer to be cured. They want these people to be helped. But they've been taught to ask only how much are you spending on overhead, which has nothing to do with whether we're actually going to find a cure for breast cancer or whether we're going to end homelessness. I like to use the example of two soup kitchens, A and B. And A tells you 90 cents of every donation goes to the cause, and B tells you 70 cents goes to the cause. Well, we've all been trained that this is a no-brainer. I'm giving my money to soup kitchen A. Look at how much more efficient they are. But what if you actually went and visited the soup kitchens and you found that soup kitchen A was serving rancid soup to about 16 people a week, and they had a really rude staff, whereas soup kitchen B, because they invested so much in overhead, is serving 10,000 people a week, they have hearty, nutritious soup, a friendly, trained staff, and they do case management. Well, geez, now it's clear I should have donated to soup kitchen B. So the question, what percentage went to the cause, wouldn't tell you anything about what good is actually being done.
Well, the idea, I don't know where the last 15, 20 years, I came to believe that 15% is a good amount of money to go to the charity itself, and the rest of my donation should go, 85% should go to the actual cause.
Right.
I don't know where I got that idea, but I think it's from doing these programs over the years with experts, I'll put that in quotes, who are watchdogs, charity watchdogs, and they kind of tell you who's a good charity, what's a bad charity, and that's their benchmark. Where did they get that figure? It's their job to figure out what the good charities are.
Well, they concocted it. You know, one of the watchdog agencies did a survey with Princeton Survey Research Associates, and they asked people, what percentage of a donation do you think should go to the cause and to overhead? Well, that's like asking the general public, how long do you think thoracic surgery should take, and then using the number as a standard for thoracic surgeons. What does the general public know about how much should go to the cause or not? And so it was the it's Charity Watch and Charity Navigator and these evaluators that have set these standards. Now, these organizations are tiny. Charity Navigator only has about 12 or 13 staff. Ironically, Charity Navigator used to tell people if a charity spends more than 1% of its budget on its executive salary, you should think twice about giving to that charity. At the same time, the CEO of Charity Navigator's salary was 14% of Charity Navigator's budget. So, again, we just keep telling people to ask this simple question about overhead and not to ask a single question about what good is being done. What are you actually achieving? How close are you to a cure for breast cancer? What's your plan to get a cure for breast cancer? I mean, imagine if we walked into a shoe store and said, bring me the shoes with the lowest overhead. I don't need to see the shoes. I don't even want to try the shoes on. I just want the shoes with the lowest overhead. Or, you know, walked out of a store with a brand new pair of shoes full of holes, saying to your friends, you wouldn't believe how low the overhead was on these shoes. Mm-hmm. No, but that's exactly how we treat charity. It's not the public's fault. The public's been taught all the wrong things. So we have to reverse that and start asking, what good is my money doing?
Well, you're
How do you know?
You're founder and president of two organizations. One is the Charity Defense Council, and the other is, you're founder and chief humanity officer of Advertising for Humanity. I'm not sure what that is. We don't need to go into that. But where does your expertise in charities and how much overhead should be and how they work, where does that come from?
Well, you know, I when I was in college, I chaired the Undergraduate Hunger Action Committee at Harvard, and we bicycled, 39 of us bicycled across America 4,200 miles in the summer after our senior year to raise money for hunger relief for Oxfam America. And then I moved to Los Angeles. I happened to be gay, and it was the height of the AIDS epidemic, and so I created the AIDS Rides, these multi-day, six-day, seven-day, grueling journeys, not for athletes, but for average people to make a difference on a heroic scale. And then I created the Breast Cancer 3 Days, and we raised about $580 million over the course of 9 years. We raised and netted, after all expenses, more money more quickly for these causes than any events in history. And throughout building that success, we were being criticized for spending too much money on advertising or paying our people too much money. And I could see, wow, we as a culture apply a completely different standard to charitable endeavors than we do to business endeavors. We would never criticize a business for spending money on advertising, yet we criticize a charitable endeavor. Well, if a charitable endeavor can't advertise, how's the public going to know about it? And how are we going to create something as big as Apple or as Budweiser or as Avon? And if we don't create things as big as Apple or Budweiser, how are we going to solve big problems like hunger and poverty? If our charities are always minuscule and quaint and cute and tiny, how are they ever going to address gargantuan social problems like leukemia, violence against women, all of the other issues they're chartered to confront? And that's part of the reason that I say charities have to spend more on overhead. They have to spend more on fundraising so that they can grow. Now, interestingly, last June, three of the evaluators, the Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance, Charity Navigator and GuideStar issued a joint press release to the American public in which they said, quote, we write to correct a misconception about what questions people should ask when they donate to charity. Many charities should spend more on overhead, they said. Charities don't need low overhead. They need high performance. This was a complete reversal of Charity Navigator's opinion.
What caused that?
Well, I think there have been a number of us over the last 5 to 7 years that have been creating a conversation in America saying, this is irrational and a disservice to donors. Stop telling donors to ask about overhead. All that happens when you teach donors to ask about overhead is charities get very smart and they find ways to show donors that their overhead is very low. And they focus more on their accounting and more on keeping overhead low than they do on impact. Stop this. This is ridiculous. We have to start to ask, what good is being done?
How do you feel about these professional fundraisers who call you on the phone at dinner time? For those of us who don't have caller ID, and mistakenly answer the phone. I mean, I have asked the question about overhead, and when they can't answer the question because they're not told the answer to the question, I say, who are you? Are you working? Are you part of the charity? Oh, no, we're professional fundraisers. And I hang up the phone.
Yeah.
So is that a good thing to do? Is it a stupid thing to do? Do charities need professional fundraisers?
Charities absolutely need professional fundraisers in the same way baseball teams need professional pitchers and professional coaches. You know, this idea that charities are going to be able to grow without a profession behind it is crazy. Now, there are different levels of integrity and professionalism. But the smart donor should be saying, I want to invest my money in fundraising. I don't want my money to go to the cause. Now, that sounds like really irrational, right? But if you're a smart donor, you say, I want my money to go into fundraising, and I want you fundraisers to turn my dollar into $10 to help kids with leukemia instead of my dollar helping providing $1 for kids with leukemia. So, for example, in the case of the Breast Cancer 3 Days, we started the Breast Cancer 3 Days in Los Angeles with an initial investment of $350,000. Within 5 years, we had multiplied that 554 times into $194 million net after all expenses for breast cancer research. Now, if you were a donor really interested in breast cancer, what would make more sense? Go out and find the best breast cancer researcher in the world, give her $350,000, and insist that every penny of it be spent on breast cancer research. Or go find the most innovative breast cancer researcher in the world, give her fundraising department the $350,000 to potentially multiply it into $194 million for breast cancer research. You see, when you tell your favorite charity, I don't want you to spend money on fundraising, essentially what you're saying is, I don't want you to go out there and find other donors. I want to bear all of the burden myself. I want you to keep coming back to me. But see, we've never taught the public to think of it that way. If we thought about it rationally, we'd say, definitely spend more money on fundraising because I want more people like me donating to you. Now, the person that calls you, you know, during dinner, some of those are legitimate. Some of them are scams. Some of them get a percentage. Some of them don't. So it's hard to say. But you have a lot of charities that serve poor constituencies who don't have a billionaire benefactor, and they have to resort to these types of fundraising to find donors. Now, it may cost them money in the short term, but over the long term, it ends up making them a lot of money.
Dan Pallotta is our guest. He is the founder and president of the Charity Defense Council. As you have, if you're just joining us, he has some ideas about charities and donations and nonprofits that will flip things on their head and maybe your head as well. We'll talk more about this as we go through the hour. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia. October delivers the new Subaru 2015 Legacy with Subaru EyeSight. Driver assist technology monitors traffic and reacts to avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And Mezzo One, an apartment community located at Colony and Roxborough next to retail, dining, Earth Fair, and more. Walking distance to South Park and just minutes from uptown. More at Mezzo One.com. Well, 2014 marks the centennial of the opening of one of the seven wonders of the modern world. The Panama Canal remains one of those wonders and is about to expand, and that expansion may actually help Charlotte because of our intermodal transportation facility. In conjunction with that and the 100th anniversary of the Panama Canal, our friends at the Mint Museum are putting a new exhibit on called Connecting the World, the Panama Canal at 100. We'll take a look at the exhibit, the past, and the future of the canal tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, campaign spending has reached new heights in state judicial elections. Why some believe the growing need to raise and spend money is undermining judicial integrity and public confidence.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dan Pallotta, the author of Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. You can see his entire TED Talk about what we're talking about here today online, and it will possibly completely change everything you think about charities and your interaction with them and how they run their operations, because he says that everything that we think about charities, about overhead, about compensation for the people who run the charities, is completely wrong and crippling for the organizations themselves. I moderated a panel discussion several years ago on the arts in Charlotte, and somebody from one of the banks who ran the corporate donation division stood up and she said one of the big problems, and most of the people in the audience were people from nonprofit theater groups and things like that. She said most of the problems in this group is that you people think that you're a nonprofit and you think like a nonprofit and you think you shouldn't be making any money and you think small and you need to think like a business, which is exactly what you're saying. But when you have people asking them, what's your overhead, or, gee, your CEO makes $250,000 a year, I'm not giving you any money, that makes them have to think small.
Right, which is exactly why we're trying to change things. We're trying to change the way the American public thinks about these things. There's only one reason to change the – we could keep thinking the way we have always thought. If we're comfortable with it and we like it and we don't want to challenge ourselves, then we can keep thinking the way we've always thought, and we will never solve these social problems. The only reason to think radically differently about charity is if we want to solve these problems. Why? Well, because if we want to solve huge problems, then we need these small organizations that are effective to grow much larger. And the only way they can grow much larger is by investing in things like the right leadership and in fundraising and in advertising so that they can have the same kind of exposure to the general public that L'Oreal has and that McDonald's has. That's the only reason to think radically differently about all of this. So the Charity Defense Council is going to do things like what the pork industry did, you know, back in the 80s. Pork was thought of as this fatty heart attack waiting to happen, and then pork producers got together, they hired an ad agency and said, pork, the other white meat, and now when you eat pork, you think you're being a model of national health. So we want to challenge the general public with ads that say things like, do you want to be the only donor? Because when you discourage your favorite charity from spending on fundraising, you're saying you don't want them to find other donors. Or an ad that features a little kid with his piggy bank, and it says, I'm going to donate all the money in my hard-earned piggy bank, all my hard-earned money in my piggy bank to the local homeless shelter, and I want them to spend 100% of it on fundraising because I want them to grow. So we're doing this incredible grassroots event called the Charity Defense March next spring. Next summer. It's a three-day march from Maine to Salem, Massachusetts, for people who care about these issues, and people can go to charitydefensemarch.org if they're interested in changing the way people think about charity so that we can actually change the world. What I say is none of us wants our tombstone to read, we kept charity overhead low, right? Or our tombstone to read, we kept the CEO's salaries low. Mm-hmm. We want them to read, we ended hunger in our lifetime. We ended homelessness in our lifetime. We cured Alzheimer's disease in our lifetime. And if we really want that to be our legacy, then we have to let go of these 400-year-old ideas that worked during Puritan times and embrace a new idea that will work for the challenges of this age.
You referenced the Charity Navigator as kind of flipping a switch on their previous stance and putting out an open letter to people telling them to think differently. But before they wrote that letter, Ken Berger, who's the president and CEO of Charity Navigator, wrote in the Huffington Post, "We believe his message, your message, has gained tremendous popularity for one simple reason. He ultimately is arguing that charities should be held to virtually no accountability standards. Dan says that people should look at results rather than overhead. But if you look under the hood for details, there is little in his argument on exactly how to go about measuring those results." What would you say to that? What do you say to that?
Well, there are ways to measure results. The way that you would measure results is you ask a set of systematic questions, but to keep it simple, those are, what are your goals? You ask the charity, what are your goals? What progress are you making toward those goals? And how do you know? Those are the three questions you want to ask. So if you were to go to a charity and the executive director of, say, a homeless shelter, and you said, what are your goals? And the executive director can't tell you what the organization's goals are, well, that would tell you, gee, you don't have a lot of intention to solve the problem of homelessness. If the person said, well, our goal is to reduce homelessness by 50% over the next 10 years, you might say, oh, that's a great goal. I like that. What progress are you making toward that goal? And if she answers, we don't know, then you would say, well, I'm not so sure I want to donate to you. But if she were to say, well, we know we're not making very much progress because we study this, 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 and that, and we can see that those things aren't working. Well, I would say, I think I'm going to donate to you because you're actually interested in what you're doing and whether it's having an impact. In the same way, a cancer researcher, like, you don't expect a cancer researcher to be successful all the time. What you expect a cancer researcher to do is research, is to keep finding out what works and what doesn't work, what works and what doesn't work, right? You fail forward. Well, that's the same way you address these social problems. And so for Ken to say that I think that we shouldn't evaluate charities at all is the opposite of everything that I've written. That I've written is I've said we have to start asking these organizations what good they are doing.
Well, he goes on to say that that your philosophy is music to the ears of many leaders in the charitable sector. Indeed, many of them seem drawn to the notion that if they follow the Pied Piper of zero accountability, that would be you, they basically can do whatever they want and get paid millions while waving the flag of Pallotta's books and his TED Talk. There will be those who would hide behind that philosophy in order to make $400,000 a year as the CEO of a charity, would there not be?
I mean, there would be. In the same way, there has been a parade of people who have hidden behind their low overhead. So the idea that overhead somehow protects us from that is absolutely ridiculous. First of all, let's look at overhead in a number of levels. Some people say, well, overhead tells us whether people are committing fraud, right? Mm-hmm. Well, how do we find out what a charity's overhead is? You look at their tax forms where they say how much money they took in and how much money they spent. Now, who on earth that is committing fraud is going to report that in line item detail on their tax forms? So people who are really criminal, who are really committing fraud, they don't fill out Form 990s, which are the tax forms that charities have to fill out. So that argument goes out the window. And 20 years ago, the Supreme Court, in a famous case on fundraising, ruled that there is no nexus, there is no intersection between high overhead costs and the existence of fraud. So that's one thing. It doesn't actually detect fraud. Now, you get the charity that tells you 95 cents of every dollar goes to the cause. We've been trained to think, wow, that's great. I know that they don't waste any money. Well, no, you don't. How do you know they're not wasting the 95 cents they tell you they spend on the cause? That's where all the money goes. That's where the biggest opportunity for waste is. And here's the other thing. Since charities know that donors want low overhead, they want very high percentages of their donation going to the cause, Charities change the definition of the cause. They broaden the definition of the cause in their accounting so that they can tell donors a much higher percentage of the money is going to the cause. So it's really this overhead measure that masks all kinds of untoward activity. The Center for Philanthropy at Indiana University looked at the Form 990s, the tax forms of 100,000 charities, and they found that half of all the organizations, half of them, and a quarter of the organizations that were raising between $1 and $5 million were reporting 0% fundraising cost. Now, how do you raise $5 million a year and not spend a penny actually doing it? So the real lie has been in this overhead measure. We think it's measuring something, and it's actually masking things. So, yes, I think we need our donors to have trust, but not in an overhead measure. They need to have trust in the good that we're doing.
But getting back to your philosophy, if we ignore overhead as a benchmark, and if we don't care about the CEO's compensation package, because you say that's holding the charity back, which we'll talk about in a second.
We should care about the CEO's package, but I'll tell you about that in a second.
Right. That these things, these rules, these arbitrary and incorrect rules that we're measuring charities against hold the charity back. Is charity, as it's presently constituted, as we presently think about it, is it working?
On a small scale, it's working. You know, so you may have a homeless program in Charlotte that works, and the homeless people that it serves well, but it cannot meet the need. There's 10 times as much need as it's able to meet. And that's where this idea that it needs to grow comes in.
How do you know you're right?
Well, we could go to any the poverty rate in the United States is 12%, and it's been stuck there for 40 years. The illiteracy rate in the United States, 20 years ago it was 14%. 10 years ago it was 14%. Right now it's 14%. The number of adults and children who died of AIDS in the world, 20 years ago it was 1.1 million. 2 years ago it was 1.6 million, despite the introduction of protease inhibitors. So, I mean, you can just walk out in our world and say, are there or are there not unaddressed social problems, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I think we see that.
So they're not making a dent.
They're not making a dent.
And that's because they're small? That's because we're looking
at the
wrong
things?
They're
tiny up against the scale of the problem, absolutely.
And you say that the problems that these charities are trying to address are enormous in scope, and the charities themselves are tiny, and it's like David and Goliath, only probably worth.
Worse. Our biggest charities, like the American Red Cross, I think is a $4 or $5 billion a year organization. Apple just sold They just had a $42 billion quarter. You know, they're gonna bring in $170 billion in revenue this year.
But is that fair? Because when I go to Apple and I buy the iPhone 6.
Right.
I'm getting something that I want in return. If I go to an automobile dealership because I've seen their commercials that they're spending a gazillion dollars on the local news every night, I go to them, I buy a car, I get that car in return.
Yeah.
If you're spending, I don't know, $100,000 a year on advertising the Heart Fund, and I decide, okay, your message has gotten through, here's $100, what do I get?
Well, you get a service that the charity is providing to help make the world a better place.
I guess the problem is, I mean, what I'm trying to get at is do people see it that way? I mean, you get an iPhone in return for whatever you're putting down at the Apple store. But if I go to the Heart Fund, if I go to the American Cancer Society, or any of these charities, if I donate to a theater company, to the ballet.
Right.
Do I see it the same way? Do I really understand that I am getting something in return for this? I am helping somebody down the road that I will never meet, or I'm sustaining an organization that provides quality culture, arts, entertainment, whatever it may be.
That depends on you as the donor, and I think we as donors have a responsibility. We take our responsibility to vote. You know, many of us who participate in our democracy, we take our responsibility to vote very, very seriously. And we spend a lot of time analyzing the candidates hours and hours before we figure out who we're going to cast that vote for. And I think we need to bring the same level of rigor to the charities that we're going to donate to. I think the average person out there, even if you're only donating $200 a year to charity, you're still a philanthropist. Philanthropy means love of humanity. You don't need to be a billionaire to be a philanthropist. And hardworking people who donate to charity should look at themselves as philanthropists, and they should ask themselves, what issue is important to me? What issue do I want to have a big impact on over the course of my life? And then they should spend some time researching an organization that they feel, this is a good organization that I would like to contribute to over the course of my life.
So thinking about an organization's overhead is keeping them small, and thinking about whether or not the CEO is compensated too much is keeping these organizations small, because you say that by limiting compensation for people who run these groups, you're limiting the leadership. Explain how reining in compensation is wrong. Why is it, you think, if you pay the head, and we had a situation here in Charlotte where the head of the United Way was making, I think, $250,000, and she's no longer making that because she's no longer at the United Way, and they're no longer paying that because people got very upset with that compensation level. Can you track compensation to the success record of an organization? How do you know? Because there are plenty of CEOs of major corporations who make millions, hundreds, tens of millions of dollars a year, and their companies stumble and fall, and they continue to make tens of millions of dollars a year. And they say, we have to pay this guy that because the marketplace demands it. He'll go someplace else. Will he?
Right.
Is the same true in charity, in the world of charities?
Interesting. We get upset when we hear that a charity leader in a nonprofit context is making $250,000. Do you know that each of the 20 highest paid college football coaches at nonprofit tax exempt universities, nonprofit universities last year, each of them made at least $2.6 million.
That's another show altogether, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. But we want, right? We want, I live in Boston, so I want the Boston Red Sox to hire the best pitcher they can possibly find, because I want them to win. And I want them to hire the best coach they can possibly find, because I want them to win. Well, wouldn't we want our charities to hire the best coaches and leaders we can possibly find, because we want them to win? And then we have to measure, are they actually worth it? This idea where we throw out numbers, like somebody's making $250,000, and we say that's too much, without having any clue what the person is doing for that money, is irrational. The only way you know if a salary is too much is if you know what you're getting for the dollar. If somebody tells you, I'm going to sell you a car for $50,000, how do you know that's too much or too little, whether you see the car? You know, if it's a used Pinto, it's too much. If it's a Maserati, it's not enough, right? Yeah. So it's the same with these salaries. I wish people would stop asking me, don't you think that's too much money? I have no idea if it's too much money. It depends on what that person is producing. And when we hear someone's making a low salary, we think that's great. Well, that's funny, because that person could be producing nothing, right? Somebody could be making 50 grand and we think, oh, that's great. They only make 50 grand. I'm comfortable with that. Meanwhile, they don't work half the week and they're taking the organization backwards. So you have to ask, what good is being produced for that amount of money? Salary should be expressed as a ratio, not as a dollar figure.
But how would I, as a giver, a donor, know what that person is doing?
Ask.
Yeah, but how would I be qualified to judge the response?
Well, you have common sense. If the head of the Boys and Girls Clubs, as this, you know, Wolf Blitzer called the head of the Boys and Girls Clubs on the carpet 2 years ago for making $890,000. And if you asked, what has she done for that money? Well, she's doubled the number of kids served. Any common sense American can say, I'm comfortable with that.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back in just a moment. More with Dan Pallotta, Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Park Sterling Bank, providing financial solutions for personal and business needs, answers you can bank on. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, details at parksterlingbank.com. And the law firm of Horak Tally, helping individuals and businesses find sharp solutions to their legal needs for more than 80 years, details at horaktally.com. Campaign spending has reached new heights in some state judicial elections. A conversation on the Diane Rehm Show about the growing need to raise and spend money in judicial elections and how this spending may affect judicial integrity and public confidence. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you would like to join our conversation, which may in fact be blowing your mind about charities, now's your chance. Check us out. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we are coming right back.
Election day is almost upon us, and those who said digital was the political wave of the future, well, take heed.
If the predictions of TV being dead are true, then it's being buried in money.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. TV as the king of political ad spaces. Also, the numbers from Wall Street next time on Marketplace. It's all from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dan Pallotta is our guest, activist, fundraiser, TED Talker. You can see his TED Talk on the subject that we're talking about right now, charities and how they're funded. He's also the founder and president of the Charity Defense Council. As we go through this program, we'd like you to go to Twitter, if you're a Twitterer and a tweeter, and tell us how you look, what you look for in a charity. How do you choose where to donate your money? And you can post your answer there by searching for WFAE on Twitter. And if we have time, we'll share some of those. And, of course, we'll share it in the Twitterverse there. There's another side to this coin about paying really high executive compensation for charities, and that is the ability to attract people. And you point out in your TED Talk that the approach that we're using today, where we limit or we try to limit the amount of money that we pay these people, gives a really stark, mutually exclusive choice between doing very well for yourself as an individual who might become the leader of a charity and your family, or doing good for the world to the brightest minds coming out of our best universities. It sends tens of thousands of people who could make a huge difference in the nonprofit sector marching every year directly into the for-profit sector because they're not willing to make the kind of lifelong economic sacrifice that we are requiring of them now because of limitations on salaries. So you really are saying that the best and brightest people out there who could earn, say, $400,000 a year at a private company won't even look at a charity because they can't make more than $80,000 or $200,000 a year.
Well, I'm not saying all of the best and the brightest, but many of the best and the brightest that we could actually use. Think about it. A person graduates from Stanford Business School, and, you know, on average, 10 years later, they're making $400,000 a year. Whereas the average hunger charity in the U.S. is paying $84,000 a year for their CEO. So that person looks at that and they go, do I want to sacrifice $300,000 a year to become the CEO of a hunger charity, or do I want to keep my $400,000 and donate $100,000 a year to the hunger charity? That way I get to keep my salary and my stock options, and I feel that I'm doing something great for charity.
But really, can charities, because you just mentioned stock options, can charities ever really compete with these other jobs? Brian Moynihan, the CEO of Bank of America, could probably be a great charity operator. He could run a good charity. But he's never going to make the kind of money that he makes at the Bank of America.
No, but there's a massive gray area, a massive distance between, you know, $250,000 a year and $25 million a year.
Yes,
you
there
know,
is.
So if you were to pay someone $1.5 million, you could probably attract them without having to pay them $25 million.
Let me share with you some things that have come in while we've been talking from people listening to us. Joanne emails, Dan states that to grow, nonprofits must invest in fundraising. What are the implications of this for a nonprofit board?
Well, a board has to be willing to either find alternative sources of capital or explain to donors that we're going to take a portion of the revenue invested in the growth of the organization.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think donors have – Board members think their fiduciary duty is to keep expenses low. No, your fiduciary duty is to make sure that this organization, which has been given tax exemption by the IRS in order to make a difference, is making a difference.
Okay. Gerald emails, criticize charities. Dan Pallotta and other fundraisers would like to redirect the conversation away from the man behind the curtain. There are real and rational reasons why hardworking people are rethinking giving hard-earned money to fundraisers. Please, Dan, step up. Don't redirect from those real and rational reasons. I'm not sure what he's saying there, but maybe you do. Maybe you are.
Well, again, you know, if you're saying, I don't want you to spend money on fundraising. It's very simple. You're saying you don't want me to find other donors. You're saying you want me to keep relying on you. If I can't spend money on fundraising, I can't find other donors. I know that you are a donor, so you're just going to be in my sights. I'm going to keep asking you for more and more money.
Mm. Bill emails, don't worry about not-for-profit overhead. Sounds like a bad argument. Following on the heels of the report of Red Cross in New Jersey, I don't want to enrich a CEO with my charitable dollars.
Yeah, what if you are actually enriching the people that the CEO serves? So, see, we personalize these things. It's very interesting. We don't personalize the amount of money the head coach of our baseball teams are paid. But we do personalize the amount of money the head coach of our charities are being paid, when in fact that person may be doubling or tripling the revenue. So let's say in the case of the Boys and Girls Clubs, the head of the Boys and Girls Clubs is being paid $800,000 and she's raising $1.5 billion a year. So let's say $800,000 is too much money. Let's go find someone for $200,000. And when you find someone for $200,000, you save $600,000 a year. Isn't that great? But she's only capable of raising $500 million a year. So you saved $600,000 on the salary and lost $1 billion a year in revenue.
Penny wise, pound foolish is
exactly
what you're saying. William emails, your guest seems to base his opinions on there being an infinite amount of available money for charity. In my experience personally and with charities I work with, I find that there is a limited amount of funds available for charities, i.e. John Doe will give a maximum $10 or $10,000 this year to charity. Each charity is competing with other charities for the finite available funds allocated to the charity pie. So if a large part of the pie is eaten by fundraising, then it has come away from other hopefully more worthy causes.
Wrong. Charities are not competing with other charities for dollars. Charities are competing with McDonald's and Hershey's and L'Oreal and Marriott and Disney and all of the other big consumer companies that are out there pummeling us with messages to buy more beer and go on more cruises and watch more movies and buy more jewelry. That's who charities – money is fungible. There's not money that you can spend on charity.
Well, let's talk about advertising, because the way McDonald's gets you in the door is by spending a gazillion dollars on I'm Loving It commercials, etc. So most charities today can't afford to advertise,
right?
Even small advertising places. They can't afford even to be those little things that you click on your smartphone when you
right.
bring up a free app. And you're saying that allowing them to advertise would be a game changer.
Yes, it would change the amount. It would take market share away from the for-profit sector. Charitable giving has been stuck at 2% of GDP in the United States for over 40 years, and that means in 40 years the nonprofit sector hasn't taken market share away from the for-profit sector. Well, how can you take market share if you're not allowed to market? I'll give you an example. We took out a $50,000 full-page ad in the New York Times to advertise the very first Boston to New York AIDS ride. Some people could say that's unconscionable. That $50,000 should have gone to people with AIDS. That ad brought in 2,000 phone calls. 1,000 of those people registered for the AIDS ride. They raised on average about $3,000. So that one $50,000 ad brought in $3 million
in revenue.
But what
if it hadn't? What if it didn't work? What if it fell on deaf ears?
Yeah, but it did.
But what if it didn't?
But it did.
But we all know. All right, we know.
Well, what if
we
it did?
We all know that.
You know, here's what corporate leaders say. I know that half of my advertising spending is no good. The trouble is, I don't know which half.
Mm-hmm.
See, we allow Apple to do that. We allow Apple to advertise without data, just knowing in a general sense this huge amount of money we're spending on advertising is bringing more revenue to us. That's another thing. What if I ran the ad and it didn't work? Well, I would learn something, right? Don't we want charities to learn things?
Mm-hmm.
How else am I going to learn whether advertising that type of ad works or not? Would we rather them stay in the dark?
We don't allow charities to
fail. Not let them fail. You know, Disney can make a $200 million movie that flops and no one calls the attorney general, you know? But you do a little community fundraiser for the poor and it flops and, you know, call the attorney general.
Why do you think there is this disconnect? Because advertising obviously works.
Right.
Obviously. If it didn't, the billions of dollars that is spent on it by these companies every year would not be spent. If advertising didn't work, every commercial on television in the news would not be for a car dealership. Sometimes the same car dealership in the same commercial break three or four times. It just wouldn't happen if it didn't work. So if it works, and it incontrovertibly does,
right?
Why do we resent charity spending money on it?
Because it goes way back. We get a sort of penitential effect when we know that nobody is profiting from charity. And this all started with the Puritans 400 years ago who came here for religious reasons, but they also came here because they wanted to make a lot of money, and those two things were in conflict.
I didn't know that. I read that yesterday. I think it was in your TED Talk. You talk about the Puritans who came here, and they were, you described them as aggressive capitalists.
They were accused by the other colonists of extreme forms of profit-making tendencies. But at the same time, they're these pious, humble, prayerful, diminutive little people. So there's this enormous psychological tension going on where they're not supposed to do anything for themselves because that will get them sent to hell, yet they've got this voracious appetite for making money. So charity becomes their answer. Well, here, in charity, we won't make any money. So, you know, we'll at 5 cents on the dollar, we can earn our penance by giving money to charity. And so charity became this domain where financial incentive was exiled. And look, I realize this stuff is controversial, and you have to ask yourself as a donor, as a smart, logical person, that simple question: what do we as a generation want on our tombstone? Do we want it to say, we made sure they didn't spend any money on overhead or salaries, or do we want to say we solved these problems?
But if a small charity wants to grow, yeah, one way to grow is to advertise. Mm-hmm. Not only what they're doing for the world, but the fact that they want you to participate in helping them do what they do.
Absolutely.
So where does that first seed capital come from? Do you take all of your donations and throw it into advertising and hope for the best?
Right. Well, that's a difficult spot that we put charities in because we don't have capital. We don't have a stock market where they can actually go and get the money for these kinds of things. You know, I told you we launched the Breast Cancer 3 Days with $350,000. That was not easy money to find. There's no system for taking fundraising ideas. There are no venture fundraising funds, and we need something like that. We need sources of capital, and it could be foundations that are sitting on $1 trillion in capital. You know, charitable foundations that give away money to charities are sitting on $1 trillion in capital because, yeah, you don't want to have to say, well, geez, if I spend that $100,000 in advertising, that's $100,000 I've got to take away today from people who I need to serve soup. Now, it could be I'll triple the amount of soup in 3 years, but what am I going to do today? So these charities need sources of capital.
Budweiser and BMW get to advertise in the Super Bowl, and they spend a gazillion dollars to be in the Super Bowl. And you're saying that what if the American Cancer Society or an HIV/AIDS organization or some other organization were allowed?
Yeah.
I mean, you got, if they could afford it, they would certainly be allowed, but morally they may not be allowed to advertise in the Super Bowl. You're telling me that that would have the kind of impact that it has for Budweiser, that people would actually – I mean, people do buy cars and stuff like that because of these commercials, but – somebody would give their money to the charity that advertises as
absolutely
opposed to buying the big screen TV and the pack of Bud?
Absolutely. I think people want, especially in this day and age of materialism, people want a sense of meaning. So we need to excite that sense of meaning more. I'm a personal living example of it. We raised $582 million in 9 years. You know how we did it? By spending about $25, $30 million on advertising. You know how much we would have raised if we put up a flyer in the dry cleaner? Zip. You know, Wounded Warrior Project, there's a great example. They did not exist 13 years ago. 8 years ago, they were spending about $1.5 million on fundraising, and they were raising about $10 million a year. They decided to spend a lot more on fundraising. They upped it to $20 million that they were spending on fundraising. This year they will raise $400 million for veterans.
You were here last night. You were speaking last night under the auspices of Wake Forest University and Queen's University of Charlotte and another organization that's going to kind of go out of my head, the Social Venture Partners at the McGlohan Theater. What kind of reaction do you get from people when you tell them this, either with people within organizations that are nonprofits or people who just come to hear you speak that maybe donate to charity? What kind of reaction do you get?
Well, last night I got a standing ovation. and some of the standers are in the room here. And, you know, it's interesting. I have a lot of lay people that come to the talks that I give, and they will come up to me afterwards and they'll say, I'm never going to ask that question about overhead again. I never thought about it in this way. I never thought about the fact that asking about overhead wasn't telling me what good was actually being done. A good test sample are the video technicians. There's always a video technician at all of these speeches, and they will consistently come up to me and say, you know, I'm not an expert in this field, but I never thought about things this way, and this has really changed my mind. So when you give the general public a common sense, rational argument that, hey, you want your money to make a difference, right? You don't want to have a low overhead with no difference. What if you could have a lot of difference in low overhead or a lot of difference in high overhead?
Well, maybe you're making a difference when you speak live, but you're not making a dent here. Jason emails, I'm a middle-class American. My wife and I combined do not bring home $100,000 a year. I have a hard time donating my hard-earned money to pay someone a $500,000 salary.
Actually, he doesn't have a hard time doing that because he probably buys an iPhone and contributes to Tim Cook's $40 million a year salary. He goes to the grocery store and contributes to the CEO's. He's constantly contributing to CEO's salaries. He just hasn't thought about it in that way. Okay. Don't you want to contribute to the salary of someone that can solve these social problems?
You want to draft a National Civil Rights Act for charities and social enterprises. What would that mean? What would it entail? What would it do?
Well, it would be a thoughtful statutory code that actually nurtures our work. So it would be new ways of reporting on the difference that we make in tax forms rather than just overhead. It would be new corporate structures. It would be new structures that allow more capital for the nonprofit sector. It would be kind of the creation of a national good index in the same way that we have gross domestic product so that we could measure the annual value that the Health and Human Services portion of charity is contributing. So innovative things like that, a proactive federal statute.
You also wrote an article about choosing a charity in which you mentioned using websites like greatnonprofits.org, philanthropedia, and givewell.org.
Yeah, you can use those, but I think really the donor should go directly to the charity, call them up and say, I want to come down for a visit. I want to sit and talk with you in the same way I do a car dealer.
Dan Pallotta has a TED Talk online about this. Also, he's written several books. One's called Uncharitable, How Restraints on Nonprofits Undermine Their Potential. And thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Charlotte talks with